Hi, this is Brendan Muldowney, the writer-director of The Cellar, and you are listening to The Graveyard Show.
Welcome to The Graveyard.
And welcome to another edition of the Graveyard Show podcast. I am your caretaker, and the graveyard is open. Well, forgive my appearance for this podcast, my friends. I've been working on a water leak issue here inside the graveyard. It's been going on now for a few days, so I've been digging in the dirt trying to find where it's been coming from. The good news is that the water leak is right near the piranha area of the graveyard, so the water's not being wasted. The bad news is that, the water leak is near the piranha area of the graveyard. Well, we will be going into the cellar for this podcast. As you heard at the top of the show, Brendan Muldowney will be joining me in just a moment. He is the writer and director of the new film, The Cellar, which stars Elisha Cuthbert and Owen Mackin. The film is going to be in theaters and streaming on Shudder April 15th. But before I get into that, I wanted to quickly run through some news and notes. Weary Pines, the duo behind the soundtracks for the documentaries In Search of Darkness 1, 2, as well as In Search of Tomorrow, they will be releasing the full digital and physical version of the score for In Search of Tomorrow on April 30th. Now, In Search of Tomorrow, of course, is the just under five-hour documentary on 1980s science fiction films. So you can check that out at wearypines.com. That is WEARYPINES.com, wearypines.com, for more details. And you can also find them on social media as well if you want to learn more about them as well as their music. And Screen Media has acquired the new British psychological thriller called Cordelia. The film stars Antonia Campbell-Hughes and Johnny Flynn. The film is written and directed by Adrian Shergold. The film Cordelia centers around a young woman, Cordelia, played by Antonia Campbell-Hughes. She's a young woman living in London with her twin sister. She meets her mysteriously alluring neighbor, Frank, played by Johnny Flynn, for the first time, but quickly becomes suspicious of his true motives. With her sister out of town for the weekend, the anxious Cordelia is all alone and consumed by her many fears. She begins to unravel and sink back into past traumas the more Frank tries to charm his way into her life. There is no date as of yet set for the film to be released, but as soon as it is, I will let you know. If you'd like to reach out to the program, the email address is gyspodcast@gmail.com. That is caretakerisawesome@gmail.com. You can send me your thoughts, comments, and if you're part of the horror community and you have something to promote, please do not hesitate to reach out as well. After this interview, I will tell you more about one of my YouTube videos that was banned, why that was, and, what happened. But in the meantime, as you hear in the background, a new grave is being added. And when that happens, that means my guest is here, and it's time for me to get to work. And joining me now is Brendan Muldowney, the writer and director of the new film, The Cellar, which will be available in theaters as well as streaming on Shudder starting April 15th. Brendan, thanks for joining me here in the graveyard.
Yeah, delighted to be here.
So why don't you tell everybody out there what your film, The Cellar, is about?
It's about a family who moved to a new house in the countryside their daughter goes missing in the cellar. And the mother, played by Elisha Cuthbert, is suspicious that the house and the cellar in the house has something to do with her disappearance.
So what is it about cellars that makes us so scared?
What is it about creepy old houses? What is it about doors yes. that creak open, balls that bounce downstairs?
Yes.
You know, look, I'm playing with lots of tropes in this film. What is it about cellars? I don't know. What is it about houses? I think it's where you're supposed to be safe. I can tell you what I don't like about cellars is when I was growing up, we had fires and I used to have to go down and get the coal down a dark old staircase into a cellar where the coal was. I didn't like it.
what goes on in the darkness in the corner of the room. So, so talk to me about the script. How did you come up with this idea? Where did the idea spring from? What got your mind rolling on this idea?
Well, it comes from I wrote and directed a short film called The 10 Steps in 2004. And it was incredibly successful for our company, who I'm still working with the same producer, Connor Barry. We own a company together, Savage Productions. But it was really successful for us. It won Best Short at the Sitges Fantastic Film Festival, which is a hardcore horror audience. And it did the whole circuit, the genre circuit, and picked up a lot of awards. But at the same time, it was going to these children's film festivals. It won Best Short at the New York International Children's Film Festival, which was running at the time. I don't think it still is. But so we just realized there was something special about it. It was hitting a very broad audience. It was, you know, it was a sort of fun horror movie. It wasn't a dark horror movie. So we sort of, you know, we knew there was something special about it. But what really got me going on thinking how I would come up, you know, write a feature was, I was noticing a lot of online comments at the time. Atom Films was a platform for short films, and someone else put the short on YouTube, and I saw a lot of people saying, "What happens next?" All discussing in the comments, "What do you think happened? What happens next?" And that was really the genesis. Then I just took that short film, which was very, you know, short films are just very bare bones. And I had to, you know, but I really tried for years, and it's not as easy as you think, because a simple little clean idea is a simple little clean idea. To make it a feature, there's a lot of extra character work, mythology work that comes in, you know, you have to sort of come up with. That took a while. I mean, I think I tried the first version of this in 2007. So, you know, it's taken a good few years. I've made other films in the meantime. You know, like I'd write something. I had the writer of Pilgrimage with my last feature take a go at a treatment at one stage. And, you know, there's been various interest over the years from the short. But it all just petered out. And it was only there recently, around 2017, when I started to take it really seriously. And I just knew that, you know, it was a commercial sort of film. It would be easier to get off the ground. And, you know, I tried, you know, originally I just tried extending the short film. So then what I tried was using the short film as a prologue. You know, it was all right. I wrote one really good version, which was really, would have been for young adults, because it was just, there was no adults in it. It was all kids. But it was, I thought it was great. It was a monster mashup. I thought it was really good. Anyway, that wasn't working out. And then finally, I just, through a lot of script editing sessions where people are really pounding you about the characters, I just sort of went, you know what, I'll be able to get away with all this, and they won't keep hounding me about it if I just give it the strongest character hook there is, which is a daughter goes missing and the parent would, you know, go to hell and back to find their daughter. So, you know, once you sort of have that, it starts to become a little easier, really, when you have a really strong character hook like that.
I can see what you mean as trying to make this as a young adult film, because I can definitely see that, having seen the film now, how you could have made the story about Ellie and Steven and made the parents secondary. But it's, and it is, it's a, it would be a very, very different film. So you mentioned, you know, the tropes in your movie. There were a couple of things that I caught that I went, oh, okay, this kind of reminds me of this. This kind of reminds me of that. And I was wondering if there were any movies that influenced you when you were putting the script and the story together, or even maybe when you were shooting the film.
You know, a lot of it's subconscious. And sometimes you have to be careful, because you go, oh, that's too close. And then sometimes you go, that's fun. That's a fun trope, and I'm going to play with it. Look, the original Robert Wise's The Haunting influenced the short film, because and not directly, but what it helped influence was I wanted to make a film that was about atmosphere and not gore. So that's where, and in the feature, there's a direct homage to the Haunting. Even when I was making the short, I was very interested. I was very influenced by, in the shooting, the style more so, in Final Destination, in the way they create an evil presence that creeps around and enters rooms. What else? You know, I didn't know there was voices from a sink in it. My daughter told me about it. And I looked it up on YouTube. Then the bouncing ball is hilarious because, yes, I had seen The Changeling years ago. I'd forgotten, but I knew that it was a trope. And I definitely feel like we do something different with our ball anyway at the start. It does something different too. But, and then I looked up The Changeling and up popped on YouTube the 30 scariest bouncing balls in horror film. So, it's a well-used trope. And that's quite a good, fun video if you want to look it up. What else is in there? I mean, there's everything in there from, The Omen. I'm sure there's more there that I could... I keep seeing all the guys mentioned. Full Cheese to Beyond in a very small way at the end. Towards the end. And there's many more, but... And some of them, as I say, are subconscious. I know there was one. There's a sort of cupboard that the son sort of has a couple of adventures in his playroom. And I had written that as when they find it and open it, that it had velvet red walls. And it used to be actually in another script. It used to be a whole sort of nearly a room where a cult might have had ceremonies, but it ended up as a cupboard. But I was reading something about the Amityville Horror, which I hadn't seen in years, and I was reading about the secret room they discover that's red. And I was going, oh yeah, that's probably where that's coming from. So look, I mean, all I can say is that I grew up watching a lot of horror films in the 70s and 80s, and they obviously filter into your writing and stuff. So the ones you're aware of can be the more fun because you really know what you're playing with,
Yeah. I mean, it's like anything, right? I mean, we've all of us that are either involved in making horror films or loving horror films, fans of it, you see all these movies and there's only, as you know, as a filmmaker, there are only so many stories you can tell. And there are only so many different ways you can shoot things, and there are only so many different ways you can do things. So, there's a difference between ripping a movie off, and there's another difference between, creating an homage or doing something in that style. And recently I've noticed that with certain movies, and I look at it and I go, that is a really nice little touch, as opposed to sitting there going, oh man, this is a total ripoff. So I thought all the moments in your film, to me, were fun moments that were callbacks, either consciously or, like you said, subconsciously, to other films that, look, not everybody's seen The Changeling or The Beyond or, all these other films. So I thought it was
especially
really...
Especially a younger audience.
Exactly. So I thought it was really, really well done. My question about the shooting of it was, did you do this during the pandemic?
Yes. Yeah. We did. We shot in November and December 2020. So Ireland at the time was in what they call a level 5 lockdown, which means you can't travel past 5 miles outside your door. But for some reason, film was designated as an essential.
That was done here in the States. I know. Yeah.
I don't know how that is, but I think it was piggybacked on the news, basically. The news cameramen have to be out there. And we were able to shoot, basically. It was difficult, but it was also, I've been asked this question a lot, so I can tell you the pros and cons. The cons were we had to test every day. I had to move away from my family and stay there. The actors had to quarantine for 2 weeks. We had to wear masks all day long, which is awkward when, these are reading glasses, but, if I'm looking at a monitor, I have to use them, and the masks just fog them up. So it was minor pains is what I'd call it. But there were so many things that were good. The actual little bubble of being all down there on location together was amazing. We wouldn't have got the locations, some of the locations I had written. We had to shoot in, it's in nowhere in Ireland. It's a tiny county in the west of Ireland. And I had written like an advertising agency that was like from a city. And I just thought, we're never going to get this. And we don't have the money to build it and make it look right. And because Roscommon County Council has this very futuristic building, and because of COVID, they were all out working from home. So we were able to shoot there. And there was a couple of other really sort of things that happened like that that wouldn't have worked out for us if another thing was COVID stopped us. We were supposed to shoot this 6 months earlier, and I would have been shooting it in the summertime. And on a low budget, you can't shoot night shoots. You can't shoot past 12 o'clock. And if I was shooting in the summer, I would have had no darkness. We would have been building tents outside the windows to put the lights up, or else you just don't have lights outside, and then it's not night. So the fact that I was shooting in November was I was able to shoot 5 hours daylight, take a break, you know, the dinner, the lunch break of the day, and then shoot 5 hours in darkness. So I got, whenever I was able to get all my scenes in darkness, in real darkness. So that was really helpful as well.
Yeah, there's nothing worse than doing night shoots and then hearing, we got to tent the house because we're going to go when the sun comes up, or during the day where it's like...
Or even worse, black out the windows.
Exactly. Yeah, it's just like, ugh. That's never fun. So that's interesting. Yeah, because I was curious about the house. I mean, that mansion is just incredible. I mean, shooting in that house, I'm assuming, without giving anything away, I would assume all of it was done in the house. One piece I would assume was done maybe in an LED stage, but I could be wrong. I don't want to give it away, but it's towards the end.
Not an LED stage, but because we're very low budget.
Yep.
The house was everything apart from the cellar. So we had to build that cellar door on the end of a corridor in the house, and we had to build a little cloakroom so that they can turn left.
Yes.
And then we pick them up in a studio.
In the cellar,
Yeah, and we built a set. Now, when I say studio, it was a disused cash and carry in the town. There was one other build, was the cupboard in the playroom where the son has a few adventures. And then the other things you're talking about, one of them was basically a blue screen and stripping down the set, you know, just leaving certain parts of it, the steps, basically. And then the void is what I call it. Yep. Lucio Fulci's Beyond. That was just another, it was a warehouse, or not even a warehouse, it was a factory. And we got as much green screen as we could, not as much as we needed. That was it, yeah. We the only practical thing there was on the floor.
Wow.
We put some sort of mulched up newspaper.
Wow, that's great. Yeah, I mean, that's the selling point, right, is that house. It's just like, man. I mean, you could imagine wandering around that place and just getting lost.
That house has a lot of history. It's where the king, you know, a lot of the high kings of Ireland were crowned. The coronation stone is right out the front door.
Oh wow!
There's St. Patrick's banner in there. There's the famous harp. There's so many famous things in it. It's a guest house. It's a 5-star guest house. It's a beautiful place. I mean, we had to pay a lot of money to get specialist antique movers to move all this stuff out of the house.
Yeah.
You know, and 4-poster beds, and like, really, we had to strip it way back, and there was a lot of paintings on the wall that I didn't want them. And then we had to get them moved as well. So virtually all the paintings that you see in there now, we've put in, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure a lot of care removing and placing back. I've been, Ireland is on my high list of places to go next when we begin traveling again. I've been dying to go to Ireland. It is such a great countryside. It's both beautiful and it has that gothic feel as well. For those that have never been to Ireland, can you talk about shooting there and working in the elements?
You know, the film I made before this, Pilgrimage, was completely, there was no interiors. It was, every day was exterior, and it was in a place called Connemara, which is right on the west of Ireland, between, you know, it's in Mayo and Galway, and it has its own climate nearly in Connemara. You know, a storm can come in, you couldn't even predict it on the phone. But working in the elements, especially, we were in November shooting this film, you can be lucky. Ireland is, it's the country, they say, that you can get every type of weather in the one day. So you can get sun, rain, snow, sleet, hailstones, a storm, wind. You can just get it all in the one day, and possibly in the 1 hour. What's it like? We work like anybody would in the elements. We have, you know, all the decent rain gear, decent boots, decent, and then you can do anything. And I've shot a lot of times in rain, and you know, there's very little that stops us shooting. You know, would want to be rain that's going sideways into the lens. And even then, now, if we had the money, I believe there is something that spins in front of the lens and keeps the rain on it. I've never worked with that, but yeah.
that's practical. I can't wait to get there. I'm counting down the days. So you were able to cast Alicia Cuthbert and Owen Mackin for the leads of Kira and Brian. So as a director, how nice was it being able to have two accomplished actors as your leads in the film?
Well, you know, I've worked with many accomplished actors, but it was particularly nice with Owen and Alicia. Owen I've known for many years. He had a small role in my very first feature, Savage, back in 2009. So, you know, it was really, and I've known him for years, and so did all the producers. We know each other quite well. So it was really nice to have Owen. And Owen's agent is Alicia, so it was very easy getting her on. And she was so nice. They were both, I have to say, that they were... So, I mean, it helped that they came over for 2 weeks and they quarantined, because they sort of got into the vibe. They had a chance to relax nearly and get into everything. But yeah, what I can say is, and I'll give you a good example about how supportive they were, is that, like, because we were on such a low budget, time was really short. And on the last night in the house, you know, the house was going to be struck the next day. When I say struck, the set, they were going to bring all the stuff back in. We couldn't go back and shoot there. So I was already overtime, maybe half an hour or something, and I couldn't go anymore. And I knew we were finished in the house, and we were shooting the very end scene. So without spoilers, you've seen that scene. And I was shooting some of those shots in one take. Now, you know, I'm going to go back to the days when I shot in film. You would never do that. And we were taught this in college, like, there may be a hair on the gate, or there may, so you don't do one take, you do at least two, three, four. But I was sometimes going, we won't get through all this. And I wasn't being like over-footaged. I didn't have two like shots that were luxury shots. The basics I needed to tell the story, I was going, okay, we're gonna have to move on after one take. And that's very nerve-wracking. And so, you know, some cast could possibly crack because they'd feel they were put under, you know, too much pressure. And they didn't. They were calm, they were supportive, and not just that, they nailed it each time on those one takes. So, you know, that's a good example of how tight we were working together, you know. I mean, obviously on good days and we had a bit of time, it was just lovely because they were together. But that's a good example of when the pressure was on, we were really tight and worked as a brilliant team. You know, they were very supportive.
It took me a minute to get used to seeing Alicia as a mom in a movie. I still have the 24 days in my head.
Yeah, well, that's what happens. We all get old. And it's not that Alicia's old, but this is the journey of life. You know, she's obviously, you know, her journey now is possibly different characters. Well, it is going to be different characters. There's no two ways about it.
Yeah, no, it was so great seeing her. So in both of them in the film, you had Abby and Dylan playing their children, and they're both excellent. And for me, the really standout scene was Abby walking down the stairs that sets up everything. It was so well acted. It was so well sold, because that's the part that you really have to progress now to get to the heart of the film. I was wondering if you spent a lot of time working with her on the scene.
You know, that's, by the way, the short film. The short film, it starts with the babysitting, the lights go out, and that whole sequence is the meat of the short film. Did I spend a lot of time with Abby? No, because, you know, and casting them was quite hard because of COVID. We had to cast, you know, online like this. But they were so good that, you know, that they shone through the screen, and I knew they were good. With Abby, I didn't need to do very much. The most I would say is that she's very in touch with her emotions and able to, you know, become emotional and teary very quickly. So the most I would have had to done there would be to explain that it's a marathon, not a sprint here. And, you know, if you're already breaking down and crying on the first step, or as the lights go out, there's nowhere to go. So, and, you know, she got that, and that was the most I had to do. I mean, that's when it's easy, because all you're doing is just saying, hold back.
Yeah. Were you playing Alicia's part on the set for that day, or was she actually there?
No, and, you know, this comes to Alicia's days doing 24. She said there was a lot of, and she only heard this afterwards in interviews, but she was very determined on set. She said, I want to be there. I'd like Abby to be there for my, because we shot Alicia's phone conversation first, and she asked, would Abby be there? And she asked the producers, would have to bring Abby down for this. Mm-hmm. And they facilitated that. And Alicia made sure that she was on set for Abby's scenes. Mm-hmm. And I only found this afterwards in interviews with Alicia, and she was saying it came from her 24 days, that there was a lot of scenes on the phone, and the way they did it was suddenly the other actor was always there, and it just made it so much easier. So it was, you know, great to have that experience. I mean, look, my instinct would say this is going to be better if we have the actor there. But sometimes, unless, you know, when there's budgetary problems and you have to bring an actor specifically down, the production mightn't go for it. You know, the line producer might say, we can't afford it.
Sure.
But when your lead says, I'm requesting the actor there, I don't have to worry. So, you know, production will facilitate it. They won't tell me they can't do it.
Yeah.
So
The character, Remy, the doctor, a very interesting backstory, and I was wondering if that was something that you created for the script, or if that was something that you had read about.
Yeah, I've read about instances of brain injury causing a change, and sometimes terrible changes, psychopathic changes, but also changes in intellect like this. Yeah,
it was very interesting.
This is a thing that happens. Yeah. And that character, I really liked. There was a lot more we cut out of him, you know, a lot more about dimensions, Mobius strips. There was a scene where he ended up having a breakthrough in his visualization and realizing and trying to call Alicia as he was leaving his office and going down a lift. And the phone doesn't answer, it's just counting.
Yeah.
And he's looking at the lift numbers going down, and they go all the way down through the ground floor. And the lift crashes and opens, and he looks out in horror at something outside.
Oh my gosh.
It's a pity that scene now was too expensive. So.
If you have it, you could just throw it on the extras.
It'll go in the sequel.
Yeah, exactly. Even better idea. Hey, I was wondering, was everybody done with counting by the end of the shooting this movie?
They weren't done with counting by the end of the shoot, but by the end of the ADR sessions, when I asked them all to count for 5 minutes, because I wanted it counting through the credits.
Sure.
And they all had count for 5 minutes. I would say they were done with counting then. Yeah,
I was gonna say, I'm sure everybody's just like, I am not counting anymore.
Yeah.
Your director of photography, is it Comerford? Or
Comerford, yeah.
Comerford, yes. You've worked with him on previous on some of your previous films. So talk about the working relationship with him. That's right. I'm sorry. Yes.
I've worked with him on all my features and a lot of my shorts. Well, you see, I was in film school. I did a diploma, and then I went back to do a 1-year degree in 99. And that's where I met Tom. He was in, and the producer I still work with and own Savage Productions with, we all met in film school. So, you know, what can I say? You know, when you've worked with someone that long and gone through ups and downs, and you're still working with them, you know, I think Tom is great. You know, he's particularly good for films like this. I think he gets the commercial sort of look, and I think that's his real... Having said that, he did a great job on Pilgrimage too, which was a pure handheld, very different type of, you know, approach. But yeah, the working relationship is we meet, he reads the script, we meet, we chat over the scenes. First we chat just about a general approach, and then we would go through the scenes, and it's a bit like shot listing, but it's not really. And I would write down my notes, and then I'd shot list afterwards. In the past, there's been films where we have storyboarded nearly it all. in the past, there's been films where I've just shortlisted because it was going to be far more vague, handheld look. And with this one, it was, we only storyboarded this sort of complicated visual effects shots, really.
I was curious because there are some scenes that really rely heavily on sound design. If there was, if you had tried to replicate any of that during the shoot, or if it was just one of those things where it's like, okay, creature's here, or you hear a sound over there, because I know some films nowadays are trying to, you know, make it a little more realistic on set. And I wasn't sure whether or not, especially if you're low budget, if you had the time or the money to be able to do that.
That's not me. You know, some people play music. Like the sound mixer on set, the location sound, asked me, did I want to play horror music during? I was to get people in the mood, and I said no, it's not my thing. Look, in the scripts, they are written with heavy sound design in them, but no, I mean, people know where the beats and action and things are happening, and then we do it all afterwards. And it's the same sound team I worked with on Pilgrimage. So I know them as well. They're a Belgian sound team. And I mean, look, I understand how important sound is. I see it as important as the cinematography. It just comes at a different time in the process. So I actually enjoy doing the sound and the grade and that sort of finish after the edit. Once the picture is locked, I sort of quite enjoy that last part of polishing the film.
So if people want to find out more about The Cellar, they can always go to IMDb, look up The Cellar to find out more about the film. And of course, April 15th, it will be released in theaters as well as on Shudder. It'll be streaming on there as well. Brendan, if anybody wants to follow you on social media, do you have any accounts or are you just off social media together?
I hate social media, but our company is there on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Savage Productions is what we're called.
Fantastic. Well, listen, Brendan, thank you so much for joining me here on the Graveyard Show podcast. It was great having you here, taking the time to talk about your film. I wish you all the success with this film, and I definitely look forward to having you back on the program again down the road.
Great. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
And as I put this interview to rest, I want to again thank Brendan for joining me here on the Graveyard Show podcast. It was great having him on. And again, the film is The Cellar, and it's in theaters and streaming on Shudder starting April 15th. All right, as I begin to close down the graveyard, just want to remind you, of course, you can find the Graveyard Show podcast everywhere podcasts exist, as well as on YouTube as well. Hey, speaking of YouTube, I didn't forget, as I teased at the top of the show, I had mentioned that I kind of ran into some weird issues with YouTube about 6-7 weeks ago or so. It wasn't something I had mentioned on my previous podcast because, well, there was nothing to talk about other than the fact that a video was banned. Yes, it was banned. And there was really no resolution. So there was really nothing for me to talk about other than the fact that one of my videos was banned. So basically, if you are not familiar with uploading videos to YouTube, and I'm going to assume most of you probably have your own YouTube channel anyway, because I think everybody does this time in our internet history. So essentially, if you upload a video to YouTube, they do their algorithm scan or whatever on the video, and it will tell YouTube whether or not there's actual copyrighted audio or copyrighted video that you've used in your upload. And then they'll mark it. It'll say copyright claim. So essentially, you know, they email you. They say, hey, you uploaded a video. You have copyrighted material. We know this, and you cannot make money off of this video. Fair enough. I mean, people shouldn't be making money off of other people's work. So I totally get that. Well, that's what happened when I started doing my video production on the Graveyard Show podcast YouTube channel called Catacombs of Horror. So I learned this when I uploaded the very first edition of Catacombs of Horror that I did, which was all about 1980s horror. So, of course, it's a video podcast. I am not on it. My guest wasn't on it. But it's all video. So, of course, I'm using movies and trailers and all kinds of stuff. So when I uploaded it, it said, you know, copyright claim. And that's when I learned how this works. So fine. I don't have a problem with that. I'm not trying to make money off of other people's work. I'm not trying to make money off my videos anyway. I do it for fun and get conversations going and entertain you guys. So I uploaded that one. I uploaded the Count Yorga vampire one. And then just recently, I uploaded the Halloween 4, The Return of Michael Myers Catacombs of Horror, where I talk about my favorite scenes and missed opportunity that the Halloween series had after that film. By the way, where are you Halloween fans? I thought you guys would be out there, you know, eating this thing up. What happened? Where are you? Do not disappoint me, Halloween fans. Get out there and take a look at this video. It's 48 minutes. I put a lot of work into this for you guys, so check it out. So anyway, getting back to the YouTube ban. So I get up one morning and check my Graveyard Show email, and I have the dreaded YouTube email saying your video has been banned. And I'm like, what? What did a little old me do on one of these videos? So I look, and of course, it's the most popular video on my channel, the Count Yorga Vampire video. So I'm looking at this thing, and I'm like, what is going on? So it was banned because of copyright. And I'm like, well, this doesn't make sense, because there are other videos out there on Count Yorga where literally scenes from that movie are uploaded. And I highly doubt all these people have permission from the studios to use this movie. So you have the ability to appeal their ruling, which of course I knew I wasn't going to win anyway, but I did it anyway. So I said, you know, look, I'm not making money off of this. You told me I'm not. I totally agree with that. By the way, there are all these other videos out there on Count Yorga as well. So if you're going to ban my video, then you got to ban all of them too. And if you're not going to ban them, then why would you ban me, right? I mean, that doesn't make any sense. And that doesn't seem very fair or just. I don't want to use the word fair. Let's use the word just. So if you're going to ban me because of copyright, now you have to wipe all these other videos off as well. By the way, if you did that with YouTube videos just in general, my guess would be you'd probably lose 75 to 85% of all videos on YouTube. That is an unscientific percentage. But having been on YouTube, I mean, you have, what do you have on YouTube? You have, you know, clips of movies. I mean, you could watch, you know, the end of all the Marvel movies, for God's sake. I mean, I think Disney owns them, perhaps. You know, they're a fairly large, you know, studio. You know, Star Wars, Star Trek, you know, old TV spots, old radio spots, old commercials, sporting events. You know how many wrestling videos there are out there on YouTube? I mean, you'd basically essentially wipe out YouTube if you took out everything that was copyrighted. So anyway, so I sent the appeal out, and meanwhile, I didn't want to wait, because for a while now, Catacombs of Horror is a playlist on the Graveyard Show podcast YouTube channel, and I've been meaning to create a separate YouTube channel for Catacombs of Horror. So I started to do that, and I didn't want to wait, so I thought what I would do is just get ahead of this. So I took the Count Yorga video, I passed it through another video editor, and I made some adjustments. I shrunk the video, I put a watermark on it, I put a property of MGM in the upper corner of the movie, so this way, if anybody, for whatever reason, wanted to pull it, they couldn't do it because of that. So I went ahead and just did a good faith effort on going, look, I'm trying to play by the rules here. Let's work together on this. So I decide I'm going to upload that as the first video on the Catacombs of Horror YouTube channel, and I put re-edit. It's not really a re-edit. Well, there's a little re-edit. My opening, I re-edited it a little bit, but anyway. So I upload the video, and I kid you not, within a millisecond of this thing uploading, boom, this video is being banned. And I'm like, wait a minute, how is this even possible? This thing just uploaded. So immediately, boom, YouTube sends me an email. This video is being banned for copyright. And I literally, when I replied to them, I'm like, how is this being banned by the studio when I literally just uploaded this thing? And I mean, this is crazy now. Now this is just getting stupid. So I just left it sitting there. I'm like, all right, fine. So I got notes on what they wanted changed, and I went back to the Graveyard Show podcast channel, and I had taken the Count Yorga video offline. I pulled it off from public to private, and I'm like, fine. So I put it back on public, and then I was going to go in and re-edit it. And as soon as I put it back up on public, it was fine. And I'm like, what's going on here? So the same thing happened on Catacombs of Horror. All of a sudden, Catacombs of Horror, the Count Yorga video, boom, it's no longer banned. So I'm like, well, this is kind of weird. No one said anything. And I probably shouldn't even be talking about this now because maybe they don't even realize they did it. But anyway, be that as it may, somebody knows what's going on, because if you go to watch the Catacombs of Horror favorite scenes from Count Yorga Vampire, on the right-hand side of the video in the playlist, you will see they put, if you want to watch or rent Count Yorga Vampire, here's where you can go. And you know what? That is a fair solution, and I appreciate that. So thank you, YouTube, for working with me on this, or whoever decided to make this work. I just wanted to say thank you for that. I think that's very fair and very cool. Meanwhile, I am going to be doing my future Catacombs of Horror in this new sort of format where I have a watermark, and I'll just put, you know, I'll give credit to whatever studio is on there. It's going to take a little extra work, but it's worth it at the end of the day. So there you go. After all that, the videos are still out there. So if you want to watch Catacombs of Horror, you got them on the Graveyard Show podcast YouTube channel. And if you want, instead of trying to search for Catacombs of Horror, when you're on the Graveyard Show podcast YouTube channel, where the top banner where I have the photo from the show, with a hand coming out of the ground, if you look just to the right, you'll see a little thing in there, and it says Catacombs of Horror. If you click on that, it'll take you right to Catacombs of Horror's YouTube channel. So, because eventually I'm just going to start putting Catacombs of Horror on its own YouTube channel, and I'll probably pull it off of the Graveyard Show podcast YouTube channel. So there you go. The drama of the YouTube ban. But in this situation, it worked out well. So again, thank you, YouTube, for working with me on this. I greatly appreciate it. And I greatly appreciate you for sitting there and listening to this. Maybe none of you are. Maybe I'm just talking to myself as I usually do. All right. I have to go because I have to fix this major water leak now going on in the graveyard. And I was just informed that the Piranha area is now starting to overflow. Cannot have that happen. Loose piranha on the graveyard's property, not a good thing. So I'm going to head out and get back to work. So thank you again for joining me here. I look forward to seeing you again very soon. And as you exit the graveyard, I would like to remind you to please lock the gate behind you. We wouldn't want anyone to get out. Until next time.